Okay, open lines here for you now for Coast to Coast. We do this every once in a while, midweek open lines. They're not as strange as we do on Fridays, but they're still fun open lines and great information. So let's get ready for your calls when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. I wanted to thank Craig Nelson, by the way. Very thorough job with his book, Pearl Harbor, and he, as he mentioned, hired a handful of researchers that worked with him to get the information. Okay, we've got open lines for you, and again, we take your tweets and your text questions as well, and we're going to start expanding that. As you know, we normally will do one every half-hour segment. We're going to be doing two per segment now because so many of these are coming in, and Tom and I think, hey, you know, let's give those folks some more exposure too. So we'll be doing two of them per segment. So get your texts and tweets going and send them to us, and we'll answer those questions too. Let's go to the phones. Virginia's with us to get us started in Green Cove Springs, Florida. Hello, Virginia. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. I'm making my annual Pearl Harbor call. I'm 85 this month.
You don't sound it.
Anyway, well, that's
good for you.
Happens when you listen to Coast to Coast. I was 10 years old, and my father was a retired Navy gunnery officer and in charge of the instrument shop on Ford Island. And they made the gyro compasses for the planes. And, of course, they were aiming for his office, and had he been at work that day, he'd have been killed, and I would have been in school and killed.
Oh.
Anyway, we had moved into the newly built Navy housing in October. Less than 2 months later, we were bombed, and our house was strafed by machine gun fire, American gunfire, by the way.
Yeah.
And my mother gave me my gifts that morning because she was afraid we wouldn't be alive at Christmas. So it was quite an experience. Everybody who was a witness there has had this really in their memory forever.
Virginia, did you ever have nightmares because of that?
I did. I had for a few weeks afterwards. We had to sleep downstairs because they wouldn't let us upstairs in the apartment in the houses. And I dreamed of Japanese pilots coming down in parachutes for weeks afterwards. But
what a time. Virginia, thanks. Appreciate that. Michael's in Waterloo, Ontario. That's out there in Canada on the international line. Hey, Michael, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Good morning. And first of all, I want you to know that all of our hearts and thoughts here in Canada are with you today on this this solemn anniversary.
Thank you, Michael. That's very nice of you.
I wanted to sort of just to approach on the topic. I understand last week, I believe Father Gary Roberts was going to, or Father Gary Thomas.
Yeah, he had to reschedule again. It's the second time this has happened to him, but he's
a busy person.
He's a very busy man. Yep.
I worked with the medical examiner's office for quite some time and have been a licensed funeral director and embalmer for 21 years now. So I've seen my share of tragedy, and I've always been interested and fascinated with the paranormal, and especially possession. And now I've narrowed it into transient possession, basically the evil that and the terrible things that we do to our own species,
mm-hmm.
and how sometimes a very normal, seeming, you know, no criminal record, no past, no psychiatric history, just a very regular, here we go person, decides, you know, all of a sudden they have their children, for instance, in the car, and they drive it off the dry dock.
Yeah, and they go nuts.
That's right. And then they have no recollection of it after. And I know that it's been looked into. There was some research that was actually taking place out of the LA coroner's office. And there was one of their head technicians who was leading that. It was the same sort of theory about, you know, transient possession and how this could take place. And he actually passed away under fairly mysterious circumstances.
Hmm.
When his postmortem took place, they found, I believe, it was cyanide in his system.
Wow. Who would want to do him in, Michael?
I have absolutely no idea. And cyanide, now, that's, you know, that's something that you very rarely see and rarely catch, too. You know, in toxicology, for instance, in the serology, you know, unless it's specifically ordered, it's not a standardized test. There is, you know, skilled pathologists will know what to look for. There's some signs that, you know, will kind of stand out if they're looking for that. But cyanide, you know, that's in the spy book, in the mystery book, and so forth.
It's not readily available at your pharmacy, that's for sure.
No, it isn't. But it was he was looking into it, and he's gone public with a few things. And he had worked there for quite a few years. And he was the head technologist for the LA coroner's office. And
yeah,
I'm pretty sure they're one of the most largest and busiest medical examiner's offices in North America anyways.
Did he have a specific theory about what is happening to people, Michael?
Well, I'm gonna bring up the D word, demonic transient possession. That it basically that it was demons or some entity were taking over and using the physical body of the person because they don't have that themselves, and being able to alter that person's will and actions in order to perform these malevolent and evil deeds.
Well, I'm telling you, he definitely was on to something, to be sure, because that is something we've talked about on this program for years. And something could be happening, because you're right. You have some people who have no police record, no history of violence, and all of a sudden something happens to them. They crack, and they do these horrendous things. It's just very strange and bizarre. So like I said, we take your tweets and your texts, and we're going to do two a segment. So let's go back to Tom in the L.A. studios. And Tom, what do you have for us? A couple things?
We are going to start with a text from Marco in Nashville, Tennessee. I heard you say the other night that you don't like bitcoins. Can you explain what they are and why you don't care for them?
Well, the bitcoins, of course, are digital currency created years ago by an individual. And it's being used as legal tender for some places. I don't like them because you don't have any really control over it. You know, it's not like cash. I mean, you're out there in the digital world with these coins that are real, and you're spending money for them, and they have value, but you don't have any control over it.
Would you buy the coins?
You buy digital coins from suppliers.
So why wouldn't you just, like, buy things online like we do now?
What do you mean?
Well, like, we go online, right? We can buy something, and it's shipped to us, and they take the money out of your account.
Yeah, well, no, the money you have is generally a credit card or a bank account.
Okay, so why do the extra step of buying some kind of online coin?
These are coins that are going to be used as tender instead of dollars, and people just want to go that way. You know, they want to get away from the Federal Reserve and go to a Bitcoin thing. I don't feel comfortable with
that. Yeah, it doesn't sound like it either.
All right, what else?
How about we do one from Caroline in Austin, Texas? She says, the other night I was thinking about the Terry Schiavo case.
That's an old case.
Yeah, 1990 to 2005, I think. What was your take on that?
Well, in those days, we did some stories above it, and that, you know, was, wow, interesting that she would bring up that story now.
You as a dad, you got to be on the parent's side.
My daughter was involved in that story, too, because she knew some of the family members. You know, I come from the old school, you wait it out as long as you can, as long as the individual is not suffering. And if they're suffering, then you've got to do what you have to do.
Speaking of your daughter, I got to tell you this.
Which one?
I don't know. You're going to tell me in a minute. But right. One of my friends who's in the industry called me, and they heard some kind of Michael Moore story with your daughter.
Oh, that was Wendy. That's my oldest daughter. She was in New York with her daughter. And somehow Michael Moore was there, the film producer, and he started interviewing her, and she went, she did her George Norrie promotion bit, and she just did her thing.
I guess he listens to the show.
Yeah, they all do.
So, hey, Michael.
All right, thanks, Tom.
Okay.
Next up, let's go to David in Nevada. Welcome to the program. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hello. How's it going?
Good, Dave. Thank you.
Pleasure to speak to you. Yeah,
you too.
Love your show. Anyway, I'd been hoping to get a hold of, what's his name, Mr. Nelson?
Craig, yeah. Great book,
yeah, Craig Nelson.
Way.
Yes.
Good job.
I used to be in the Navy. I served on two submarines.
Well, thank you for serving.
Well, thank you for serving. My second sub pulled into Yokosuka and Sasebo, Japan, and we got to do a little bit of exploring while we were there, including a run to the Memorial Museum in Nagasaki. And one thing I remember when I reading about the atomic bombs that we dropped over there was that nothing was supposed to grow for 140 years.
Mm-hmm.
I was stunned. It is so overgrown right now with trees.
It's gone the other way, hasn't it?
Yeah, well, the only evidence of the attack is what they preserved in the museums.
That's right.
And so that leads it to 2 points. Number one is right in the middle of the memorial there. There's a statue of a guy pointing to the sky, and there are three signs. One is in English, one is in Japanese, and I think the other is in Chinese. And they read, or at least the English one reads, and I quote, "This was the epicenter of the unprovoked American nuclear attack on Nagasaki."
Oh, unprovoked.
Yes, and that's one thing that a bunch of us from my sub, we were, a bit offended over it, but I'd like to differentiate. There are, like in all societies, there are wonderful Japanese people. I got to meet a lot of them.
Absolutely,
Japanese.
Yep.
So I don't hold that against them, but Greg Nelson mentioned about that they're not teaching them, well, this would be clear evidence that they are not teaching them the truth in that. And the other point I had was, now I was on a nuclear sub. I lived right by the reactor, obviously. I mean, right in front of it.
Were you a Rickover guy?
A what?
Admiral Rickover guy?
I do know of Admiral Rickover.
Maybe before your time.
I never met him. He's a big name in the Navy, so
oh, sure.
I read his name plenty of times. Now my dad was also in. He was on the USS Francis Scott Key, a different submarine, in the 70s. But anyway, I am a fan of almost all power sources. I like a variety, and the reason being is because when I looked at Nagasaki and I compare it to what I've heard of Chernobyl. I see that they've cleaned it up. I mean, we had many different ways of measuring radiation and all, and we never had a problem over in that area. On the other hand, I think it was a dumb idea to put Fukushima right on top of such a...
Yeah, that wasn't smart. Earthquake fault.
I think that that they should, like off of California, when they need, they need water and they need power. I would say, like a submarine, which can go under the worst of storms, I mean, you go 150 feet or lower than that, and it is calm no matter how rough it is up there. I think they should have submersible nuclear barges that can make, evaporators, make power. Anytime there's a storm coming in, they can unplug, just like they have cables going under the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
They could submerge the barges, wait until the storm goes past, and they can go back up and continue making good, clean, distilled water that they send to the badly needed area, as well as power.
That's smart. They should be doing that.
I believe that they are not telling us something. I believe they have a way to clean up a lot of the nuclear waste that they use as an excuse not to make reactors. And my last point is, if it makes so much waste, what exactly is depleted uranium, which they use depleted uranium rounds for, like anti-tank and stuff like that?
That's right, and for the outside of tanks.
and that's beyond my my expertise, but I think that they have a way to deplete the stuff and make it safe and recycle it for us something useful.
Interesting take.
So I wish that they would look into that and be honest with us.
Interesting take. I don't know if they'll ever be honest with us, David, about anything.
Well, you are, so I, that's a good start.
Yeah, that's
there,
right.
I appreciate you.
Hey, when you were in a submarine, did it was it strange to be underwater like that?
Actually, if once we were again, if we even felt the slightest motion other than, you know, forward or backward or angles as we changed depth,
mm-hmm.
If we were 150 feet, it was like being in a room with no windows. You can't feel a thing.
Did anybody ever freak out because they were underwater?
Well, most guys that would do that, they freaked out before we would go underway. We'd get a new guy in.
Yeah.
And as it got closer, he'd get more. I mean, he'd see it. Some people are claustrophobic beyond control.
Oh, that's right. Exactly.
And they can handle it for a few days, but when they suddenly feel, hey, 3 days from now, we're going underway and I won't be able to leave. Yeah, we had a few that we lost from because of that.
I was in an elevator a couple days ago. And it was just really slow for the doors to open, almost as if it was stuck. And there was a person in the elevator with me, and he was like freaking out just from that little moment. And, you know, eventually you're going to get out. You're going to, you know, sound the alarm. They're going to come and get you, and you'll be okay. But he thought that was it. It was the end of the world. So I can imagine what it's like for some sailors who get claustrophobic, not a lot of them, but, man, when they're underwater, what a problem that would be, huh?
Well, my dad, on his side, they did have one guy, he literally freaked out and attacked his fellow shipmates with a large monkey wrench.
Oh, my God, he went crazy.
Yes, he went crazy. Well, they have a method that's tried and true. It's a temporary cure-all until they can get the guy to a safe place, you know, off the sub.
Yeah.
It's called a Thorazine shuffle. They give him Valium, and then they try to shift it to Thorazine to keep him from getting addicted until they can get him off. It's the
that's
only way they can control him on the short term.
Good point. Hey, thanks, David.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate your show.
Great information. I only had one moment where I really felt claustrophobic. I didn't like it. I had to get an MRI years ago, and they put me through the tube one, not the donut. The donut with the big hole, you can look out and everything else, you're fine. But this was a tube, and, you know, you're like 2 inches away from the top, right? Your nose is 2 inches away from the top. You're in this tube, and they give you an alarm to hold. And they said, if you need to get out, squeeze it, and the nurse will take you out. And so you're in this tube, and she says you can't breathe a lot and you can't move, and you're sitting there for 20 minutes with a tube 2 inches from your face, the top of it. Hated it. Just absolutely hated it. We're going to come back. More open lines on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Had an opportunity today to see an old friend of mine who started a Mexican restaurant chain in St. Louis, Ramon Gallardo. Most of them have closed since. What an incredible success story. Came from Mexico, was a dishwasher, and learned the restaurant business, and felt that he wanted to make an authentic Mexican restaurant. And he was in St. Louis, so he went and got a small business administration loan, ended up paying it off in 18 months. Built his first restaurant. It was called Those People in St. Louis. Know his name, Casa Gallardo. And within months, the big company General Mills came up to him and made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And then they started going around the country. At one time, they had 40 restaurants, and he was the president of that division. But I haven't seen him in years, and just picked up the phone a couple days ago. Now that I'm back in St. Louis for the holidays, and I'm going through a checklist of people that I've been in touch with or I've been in close with, but you know how time and space and distance kind of pulls people away. So I'm going through this list, calling these people, and it's really cool. It's really neat to do that. And Ramon was on that list, and I said, Ray, we got to get together. So we did today, and it was great. He's in his 70s now. Really hasn't aged at all in the years that I knew him, and used to work with him because when I was a public relations executive for a couple of years, that was one of my accounts. And, you know, he and I would fly all over the country whenever they opened up some of their new restaurants. But it's fun during the holiday season to get together with people that you know and care about and recollect about things. But he's doing great. Ramon Gallardo, great guy, well-known in St. Louis. Mark in St. Louis, here you are. Mark, you know the name, right? Casa Gallardo?
I want you to do me a favor, George. I want the green chili recipe. You
know,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
I miss those places.
Yeah, I do too. You know, you made an interesting comment earlier. You said you can't believe it. It's been 75 years since Pearl Harbor.
I know it.
You know why? We're getting old.
Yes, we are.
I mean, that
clock is ticking.
You've got about 6 years on me, but we're getting old.
You're going to catch up. I'm going to stay the same, and you're going to catch up with me.
Well, that may be so.
If that's possible.
I wanted to kind of, I don't know if I would call it correct or just make some observations about, you know, your guest and some of the things that he said, and then some of the other people that called in. Well, number one, the Japanese Zero was not a copy of Howard Hughes's race plane. That's a myth, period. Secondly, it was way better than a Wildcat. In fact, Joe Foss, you know, who was really in the scheme of things the top Marine ace, said that the only way that the Wildcat was good against the Zero is if there was two Wildcats. And, you know, coming from the Navy, I'm sure you've read about, you know, Jimmy Thatch and the Thatch Weave, and that's one of the ways they were able to combat it. There was actually a number of pilots that actually got up that day. It was actually George Welsh, Ken Taylor, another guy named Phil Rasmussen, I think, actually got up in a P-36. He was in his underwear, or not underwear, I'm sorry, his, pajamas. And shot down a couple of planes, and another guy named Harry Brown. And then as far as whether or not, that we had the code at least for the diplomats,
mm-hmm.
The guy was correct in that we hadn't broken the military code, but we were getting enough information on those diplomatic, translations to kind of figure out that after November 25th, it was pretty much set in stone that something was going to happen. And I think the last transmission came in like on December 6th, and it pretty much was so startling that, that the guy that, there was only one guy that was actually able to take the things to Admiral Stark, who got it.
And nobody listened to these people, did they?
No, and they didn't. And really, what it comes down to, I know my brother, when he was in high school, he had to write a term paper, and he wrote that he thought that Roosevelt purposely got us into the war with Pearl Harbor. I didn't believe it until actually I had listened to that. I guess, is it Douglas Dietrich that you had?
Yes, yes.
Times? And of course, when I was listening to this stuff, I thought, oh, this is such a bunch of, you know what? And then I went back and I researched what he said, and he was accurate.
Oh, he's good. He's very good.
Very, very good. But if you're in St. Louis, I don't know what time you're going to get up, but if you have cable, there's actually tomorrow on, it's either the History Channel or the American Heroes Channel, they're going to have a thing called The Truth About Pearl Harbor. And it'll actually talk about a number of these things that I said. Really, it was just a huge intelligence failure.
Oh, yeah. See, I'm wondering, Mark, if they wanted it to happen.
I think they did, and I'll tell you why. Your guest basically said that it was only like a very short time before we would have been into the war. I disagree with that. In fact, I adamantly disagree with it, because at that time they had done a survey shortly before Pearl Harbor, and only 8% of the population wanted us to actually get into a war in Europe. And when Churchill found out that America had been attacked, oh yes, of course he was sorry, but he was elated because he knew now that, you know, you had a huge economic strength, that could come in and help fight the Germans. And I didn't know about the Russian, ship, that had seen the Japanese fleet,
mm-hmm.
but chances are, I would think that Stalin probably would have wanted the same thing. The war wasn't going too well for them in 1941.
That's right. Everybody wanted us in.
Yeah. But, no, it's just amazing to me because, another guest of yours called in and talked about how the kids aren't being taught things in school. and I'm not going to say where I live, but my daughter was one of the smartest, you know, kids in her school years ago, you know, ended up going to an Ivy League college. And
good for her.
I remember when she was studying for something, I guess it was like a college level entrance thing or something that they have to take. She said, "Dad, you know a lot about World War II. Will you help me study?" And I'm fine. You know, I'm like, okay, fine. Well, I was amazed, George. All they basically knew was, you know, Pearl Harbor, Hiroshima, the Holocaust, and the atomic bomb.
Right. The big things. The big things.
Yeah. I mean, I said, well, did they ever talk about Guadalcanal? No. Did they ever talk about the Doolittle Raid? Did they ever talk about Saipan? Did they ever talk about Tarawa? Did they ever talk about the Macon Island Raids? Or, I mean, they hadn't heard of any of this stuff.
No.
And the one thing that I really wanted to leave people with is that if we don't study history, then we make the same mistake.
That's right, Mark. We have to study history.
That's what I'm watching us do today.
You got it.
And it's very, 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 very scary.
You can see it, Mark. Thanks for the call.
All right, thanks, George. Okay. Hey, enjoy time in St. Louis.
I love it.
All right, I'd say stay warm. I guess
it's been kind of nippy.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to snow a little bit. I mean, we're just going to get like some minor flurries, I think, tomorrow late. So you'll be looking forward to getting back to California.
A little snow before Christmas is fantastic, especially when you're a guy from the Midwest, born in Detroit. So I'm used to that. Let's take another call here. Steve in Pennsylvania, welcome to the program. Hey, Steven.
How you doing, George? Been a while since I talked to you.
Thank you, Steve. Hope you're well.
Doing very well on yourself.
Good. Everything's good.
Good, good. I'm wondering, have you ever heard of the term shellbacks, Ancient Order of the Deep?
I have not. Tell me about this.
Well, my father, I come from a military family also, and it's continuing with my sons. They served in the Gulf War, too. But the shellbacks, it all goes back to Pearl Harbor, but D-Day is where it began. My father, he fought in Europe after the D-Day invasion.
Right.
Okay, but after Pearl Harbor came, they had to move troops from Europe to the Pacific scene.
To the Pacific scene, that's right.
Right. Well, the men, the soldiers that were transported by ship to the Pacific Theater, and my father was stationed in the Philippines. But the soldiers there, all branches, except for the Navy, were members of an organization called Shellbacks.
Shellbacks.
Ancient Order of the Deep, meaning that they fought in Europe, and then when Pearl Harbor got hit, they went right over to Pearl Harbor and started fighting the Japanese.
Wow. They were in two fronts.
Exactly. Yeah, I got all this. I have all this collectibles that he had, even a radiation detector issued to him when they were getting ready to drop the bombs.
Yeah. God, what great, what history.
Yeah, I was doing some research. Actually, last week, my sister found some papers, and I was interested in them, and that's what I found out.
That's irreplaceable material, Steve.
Treasure. A treasure.
You got it. Hey, thanks. Tom, you've got a text. You got a tweet. What do we have back there?
We have a text from Dory in San Diego, California. Okay. I've been fighting my kid over a video game I won't buy him because I think it's too violent. Do you think these games can harm children?
Oh, yeah, there's no question. In my mind, I think some video games that are violent have taught kids violent tendencies. I think it's obvious. We should do a show with Dr. Bregan about that, Tom, but I'm convinced of that.
So where do you draw the line? What about music?
Music?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we've all got different tastes in music, but, you know, hate music. It's screaming type stuff. What do they call it now?
It's thrash metal.
Thrash
metal,
that's what they call it?
Well, yeah, it's just screaming and guitar.
Yeah, well, I don't know.
Watching, you know, a million thrash metal guys listening. So we have another one from Marina in Tallahassee, Florida.
Okay.
Did you see the story about the man who died from driving his car in a tree while texting. What do we do to solve this problem?
I had that story last week.
What do we do to solve the problem?
You can't. I mean, California, you cannot hold your phone while you're driving, yet I still see people there on the phone, sending text
all
messages,
the time.
Doing crazy things. And, you know, you put your head down, you look up, and you're going to ram into a car or something. It's horrible. I have made it a personal practice that if I get a text message in the car, I will not look at it until I'm at a red light. And even then, you get caught once in a while.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if they're going to have to make it to where, you know, like when you transport a gun, you have to put it in your trunk. I wonder if that's how they'll eventually make it with phones.
They might.
Solve it.
And, but, you know, a lot of new cars nowadays, though, are capable of using your phone through Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a little safer, at least.
Not everybody can afford the new cars, though. So.
No, that's true. Okay, thanks, Tom.
Okay.
All right, Jim is truck driving in Michigan. Welcome to the program. Hi, Jim.
Hey, good morning. Hey, nice show. I like this.
Thank you.
Hey, I was really excited when you guys came over from... over to the Truck Driver Channel, Road Dog.
Oh, yeah.
Hey, it's great. 146. I enjoy that.
It's a great signal.
What do you think about military that's not American being over here?
I don't like it, Jim. I don't like it at all.
I'm asking is because I live in Ionia, and I was headed over to Lowell, and I stopped along the way. There was three military vehicles that were pulled over. One of them had a flat tire. Well, I've got jacks and things to switch tires. I didn't know if they just needed help. Well, I approached them. And the first two I talked to didn't seem to speak English. It was more like a
weird
European. And then another guy comes up, and he was able to speak, and he said, no, they didn't need any help. They had backup coming. But I just got to thinking. After I left, I remember that there's no U.S. flag on their shoulder. There's no insignia whatsoever on their uniforms at all.
Yep, they are in this country training with the United Nations, and I don't like it. I don't like it at all.
That's a little scary, George.
Yep, it's a bad precedent.
What Obama's doing over there, you know, they could just take over any time.
Yep, and I think we're doing the same thing. We've probably got U.S. troops everywhere training in different countries, too. Of course, we know we do. But, I just don't like it.
Our boys and girls in the National Guard, they wouldn't do anything to us, you know, Americans. But if something happens over here, then...
There they are, ready to go.
The foreigners don't have any problems putting up in our place.
Exactly.
Camps that some of your people talk about.
Dangerous precedent. Jim, drive carefully out there.
Hey, thanks. I'll keep listening.
You know how I love JFK stories, and I've been reading a few more new books on that. And I've got to tell you, we did, as a nation, covertly, through the CIA, we did anything we could to try to kill Fidel Castro. I mean, it was unbelievable engaging the mafia, engaging disgruntled Cubans, all kinds of things. And several of the people involved in trying to assassinate Fidel Castro ended up being involved in Watergate years later, too. What a situation that was. And in many cases, JFK didn't even know what was going on. They kept him in the dark. And I'm convinced the mob had a huge role to play in his death because of what he and Bobby Kennedy were doing to the mob. They wanted him out. And I think they were probably the ones that did it. Next up, we have Jim in Lincoln, Nebraska. Hey, Jim, welcome to the program.
Hey, George, how are you doing?
Good, Jimmy. How about you?
A little cold.
Yeah, it's that time of year.
Arctic thing dropped down. They were telling us was going to do it, and it's supposed to stay this way for the next couple of days.
I guess,
like, high of 18 degrees kind of thing.
Wow.
Anyway, I was calling back to see if you had visions of twitching rattlesnake in a frying pan in your mind in the last few days. I just wanted to know if I planted the seed well or not.
Yeah, you did. Unbelievable.
Okay. Well, also... Man, I just sitting here listening to the show while I was on hold, there's like several different things that came up that I got to mention real quickly. One was your caller that called in and said that they had some people kind of freak out on the submarine. They gave them Thorazine to get them under control. I used to work in a maximum security mental hospital for like 27 and a half years. And one day we were, myself and some of the other staff, we were sitting inside what we refer to as the cage. It was up on the maximum security floor where we were like inside plexiglass and bars, you know. And these three black guys from Omaha come walking up in front of the cage, and they just stand there with their backs to us. And we're like, okay, what's going on here? And all of a sudden, this other guy comes up, and he says in sort of a Ed Sullivan-type imitation, he goes, "Ladies and gentlemen, direct from Omaha, it's the Thorazine." Spin around and start doing My Girl.
All right, we're going to hit the break. We'll be back.